public hearing on today is Senate Bill 212, and I understand we've got, is it Scott Teege? I know I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Come on up, Ty. William Buckley, Marv Campbell, and David Yandell. So who's running this show, David?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Yandell. I'm the director of the Law Enforcement Data System with State Police. With me this morning, to my left and your right, is Mary Campbell with our ID Services Section. To my right, your left, Mr. Bill Buckley, who is also a manager with our ID Services Section, and Scott Tye, who is with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Mr. Buckley will be presenting our formal testimony at this time, if that's your wishes.
Yes, go right ahead, Mr. Buckley.
Chair Menace, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Buckley. I'm employed by the Oregon State Police and a member of their Identification Services Section, and I'm here to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 212. Senate Bill 212 came about as a result of a comprehensive federal review of Oregon statutes as they were submitted under the authority of Public Law 92-544. That law basically gives the FBI the authority to conduct fingerprint background checks on non-criminal justice agencies. Of the many statutes that were reviewed, there were four statutes that did not comply with public law, with federal law. Those included the concealed handgun permit statute, racing commission, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and polygraph examiner's licenses statutes. Senate Bill 212 amends those statutes to be in compliance with federal law. And the bill that's before you amends those particular statutes. If there are any questions that you might have, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Why don't you run us through the process right now, the fingerprint process and sending prints to the FBI, and how often that happens, and whether or not this bill affects any of that, any current practice.
Chair Menace and members of the committee, through the licensing application, and I'll use the concealed firearm permit as an example.
Okay.
Fingerprints are taken by the sheriff's office as part of their process for an application for a concealed handgun license. Those fingerprints are sent to the Oregon State Police Identification Services Section, where a fingerprint check on state records is conducted. The sheriff's office at that same time conducts a name, date of birth check through the federal system, the National Criminal Information System, or NCIC, and they do that in conjunction with the law. If there is, if there are multiple hits based upon that NCIC hit, the sheriff's office may request at that time that those fingerprints be sent to the FBI for a fingerprint check to positively match the individual that's applying for that concealed handgun license with the information that's contained in the NCIC records.
Okay, so what you're telling me is we don't send all fingerprint checks to the FBI, but only in cases where there's a need to clarify who the actual person is making the application?
Chair Menace and members of the committee, for the concealed handgun licensing, that is true.
Okay.
On other statutes, for instance, and I might have to defer to Mary Campbell on this.
Okay.
The polygraph examiner's licenses, for instance, are retained records, and I believe they are required to have a national fingerprint check be conducted.
All right. Sorry, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. It's unclear to me what would change under this bill in the concealed handgun license area.
On the concealed handgun licensing area, the only change that would take place would be if the sheriff's office makes a determination through their investigation that a national fingerprint check needs to be conducted. It gives them the authority to do so under public law.
I see, but they've been doing it anyway. Is that correct?
Correct. All of the four agencies that are that the Senate Bill 212 reflects have been doing the fingerprint background checks as a matter of course. When public law was identified that these four ORSs were not in compliance, the federal government gave us a leeway, a period of time, in order to correct the deficiencies. That period of time ends July 15th of this year.
Thank you.
All right. In saying that, I'm assuming what you're saying is the access to those records and the work being done on those fingerprints is authorized under federal public law, but because we have no corresponding statute, federal government would not ordinarily accept those fingerprints for analysis. Help me understand that part. Why do we have to conform? Why do we have to have a state statute that does?
Chairman Ennis and members of the committee, federal law requires that certain things take place in order for the FBI to conduct a national check of their fingerprint files.
Okay.
Part of that requires that the state enact legislation. The other part additionally qualifies that the state police are the recipients of that, of the fingerprint files, and through their auspices that the non-criminal justice agencies can perform that fingerprint check.
All right. And does this have a fiscal impact to Oregon, to the Oregon State Police at all?
Chairman and members of the committee, no, it does not at this time. The fees are already set in our standard.
All right, Senator Walsh.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What I understood was that even though the agencies are already doing it, it's not in statute requiring them to do it, and the federal government wants that in there, correct?
Chairman and members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. Then my second question, which is going to be helpful to me and saves me a phone call, because I have a bill to require background checks for host families who are hosting foreign exchange students. Can you tell me how much it costs to do a background check?
Chairman and Senator Walker, the fee for a national fingerprint background check through the FBI is presently $24. Now, depending upon if the agency is a volunteer agency and we're talking about a search and return type of state identification process, that fee is currently $12. If it's a retained, for instance, like the polygraph examiner's licensees, if it's a retained file that we keep on file, the charge is $15 for that through the state. So between the two, you're looking at either a $36 fee for non-retained fingerprint background checks, state and local, or a $39 fee.
Okay. I think I'll call your office and have you send me something about that so I can have that from the records. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Carriol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The statute in almost every instance indicates if a national check is needed. And I guess I'd like to know who makes the determination about whether a national background check is needed.
Chairman Ennis and Senator Farioli, for the concealed handgun portion, that would be the sheriff's office would make that determination whether a national fingerprint check would be required. I would have to, again, defer to Mary Campbell on the other regulatory agencies, whether that is a requirement of their agency or whether that's a voluntary function as far as the national fingerprint background check.
Senator Maness and Chairman, one of the things I want to add is...
State your name for the record, please.
Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Mary Campbell from Oregon State Police.
Thank you.
Regulatory unit. One of the things I was going to say was that they have an agreement to run these cards through the regulatory unit. They send in fingerprint cards because it's a positive ID. We run the record through Oregon first. If the record comes back and shows that it's already in FBI or in triple I, we do not run the card through FBI and charge them an additional fee. These checks are done if they do not already have an FBI record.
Thank you.
Any questions? Who develops or does anyone develop rules governing any of the decisions about when an NCIC check would be necessary, a federal check? Mm-hmm. Or is it left to the sheriffs and the 36 counties to decide?
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, if we're talking about the concealed handgun licensing,
right.
It's the sheriff office by statute runs a state identification through the Oregon State Police, and that is a fingerprint-driven ID.
Right.
They are also required to run a national NCIC check. Now, whether that's in statute, I'm not sure, so I'll get back with you on that.
Well, it looks pretty loosey-goosey here in terms of this is the new language, if a nationwide criminal records check is necessary, but it really doesn't say when that's necessary or how that's defined. So I'm assuming that the sheriffs determine that.
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, that is correct. They would be the determinant.
Do the sheriffs report to the Oregon State Police on the percentage of individuals who they require NCIC checks of as a percentage of total applications for CCW permits?
Chair Minnis and members of the committee, the sheriff's office as part of their standard procedure would run that NCIC check. When the fingerprint cards are sent to the state police, basically that's giving us the opportunity to run a state identification through the fingerprint file. If we find that there is an FBI fingerprint hit on that particular individual, as Mary Campbell mentioned, we process that through and give that back to the sheriff's office for them to continue their investigation in that regard.
Help me understand this. If you do a criminal history check on an individual and they come up with an Oregon SID number, oftentimes you can identify that there's also an FBI number associated with the SID number. Mm-hmm. That is happening at the sheriff's level, correct? Or not? I'm trying to figure out. You guys, I'm trying to figure out who's doing what
right.
here. Or if you're duplicating,
Chair Minnis and members of the committee. Normally, it's the sheriff's office that's conducting the background check, with the exception of the state ID. The fingerprint files come to our office if there is an identification with the state SID, state identification number. That, as you mentioned, would also more than likely show a federal hit if there is one. And what we do with that record is we check and we take the fingerprints and run it through the automated fingerprint identification section to positively match fingerprint with the applicant. Once that takes place and we establish that state identification number, that information is sent back to the sheriff's office for them to run that state identification number through LEDS, through the law enforcement data system.
But okay, I'm a little confused. Did I do these kind of checks from time to time as a detective? And it's not too difficult to run a criminal history check and find an FBI number, an SID number, you know, contact local agencies, and you know, et cetera. So it almost sounds like it's happening on the sheriff's level, and then there's something transmitted to the Department of State Police, and the Department of State Police then duplicates the same activity, does the CCH. I'm trying to figure out what you do that's different than what the sheriff's office can currently
Senator
do.
Senator Menace and committee, I think the difference is when the sheriff is running these checks or some of the other agencies, they're doing a name and date of birth check
right.
through the LED system. If they get a hit, what they're doing then is sending the fingerprints to us, and we're doing the positive ID on those fingerprints. I think that is the difference.
Right, you're doing the verification.
We're doing the verification of that is the person or not.
All right, that's what I was missing.
I'm going to take another wild stab here, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like to me if there's no FBI file, they forward the fingerprints to the FBI and create the file.
Mary?
Senator Menace and committee, you have to remember that a record is only as good as the latest information given. What we're also doing is checking, when we're checking with FBI, we're checking to see if there are any other states that there are records with, and then we're notifying the Sheriff's Department in this instance so that they can then go to that state and see what kind of record is there, whether it's another concealed handgun license or if there actually was an arrest.
Senator
Mr. Chairman, at the end of the day, the first applicant, first time applicant for a concealed weapons permit, submits fingerprints. They ultimately repose in the FBI files at the end of the day.
Yes.
That's the point.
Right. Now, does the FBI or the NCIC system create an FBI number for an individual whose fingerprints have been submitted?
Senator Manis, the committee, yes, that would be it.
Okay, so if I applied for a concealed weapons permit, and I have no criminal convictions anywhere, and these were forwarded to the FBI because there's some other John Menace out there, and there are some others, and there's some confusion about criminal history, would I then have an FBI number?
As an applicant only, you would not have an arrest record.
I understand that.
Okay.
I wouldn't have an arrest record, but I would have an FBI number.
Yes, you would.
Hence an FBI file
yes.
connected to my state identification number that's generated because I'm a police officer. And
yes.
Et cetera,
et cetera.
Okay. And I think that's the point that Senator Farrell is making. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Lady.
Chair Menace and members of the committee, thank you very much.
And now we're going to hear from the ever-present Andrea Meyer. ACLU. Notice I didn't say omnipresent. I said ever-present.
Chairman, as members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. I think actually it's the only second time I've testified in front of you, and I actually wanted to pick up on what Senator Farrioli was concerned about. There's been a policy practice maintained in this body over the years that when background checks are made of individuals who are not suspected of any crime and they are sent off to the FBI, that the fingerprints are then returned back to either the state agency that requested them and either, well, they are either destroyed by the FBI. If they are not destroyed by the FBI, they return back to the state agency. If the state agency does not destroy them, they return them back to the individual. And that's been, I believe, consistent in their background check laws. It's not in here, and we'd like to see that. I think last session Senator Courtney had a bill dealing with children and background checks on adults who dealt with that. That language was put in there. And I believe Representative Kefouri also had a bill at one point. I start merging sessions, but...
So what you're saying is that if there is no criminal history, that those records would then be returned to the state.
Right, that we do not start maintaining databases of individuals mm-hmm. who have not engaged in any criminal activity.
All right. And, all right. We'll have to... Do you remember the bill numbers?
Or no, I don't, and I was trying to look for the statute that carries the language. I know it appears in a few places, and Craig is shaking his head mm-hmm. yes, so...
All right. We'll have counsel take do a search of the statutes.
Great, thank you. And I think it would be for each, it would be probably be appropriate for each section that mentions what that the fingerprints can be
all right.
taken.
And I'm assuming the folks from the Oregon State Police, David, and did you get the testimony?
I did not.
You did not. There's apparently some language in other statutes where the records checks are looped back to the state if there's no criminal history found.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Your question again?
Andrea Meyer testified that in a past bill, in a previous session, there was language added into a bill similar to this where that if there was not an individual found to have an arrest record or criminal history, that those records would then loop back to the state of Oregon and be destroyed or...
Richard, right, and it's actually Senator Minnis' committee. It's not just last session. It's been a policy that's been throughout the statutes. And
right.
So
okay, and I think I remember these all the way back to 89. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So if we added language to this bill to do that, I'm assuming that the state police would not have a problem with that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't believe that we would have a problem with it. Based on, though, the advice that the FBI has given us, this language represents what they were recommending as a courtesy. I think we'd like to run it by them, but we would certainly entertain that.
That would be good, but and I'd like to know, are there financial penalties for not, you know?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so.
Okay. Well, let's work that out, and you have contact with is it the FBI or some other organization?
We'll be happy to. We'll get that
okay.
done right away.
Let's get some clarification on that, assuming that the process already exists. If not, we'll talk again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions on Senate Bill 212? If not, anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 212? There is not. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 212. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 90. Mr. Landauer. Commander Mike Garvey and Sergeant Rod Lusich, Portland Police Bureau. I recognize you all. Mark?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for hearing this bill today. This bill was introduced at the request of the City of Portland, and we've introduced it for a couple, frankly, simple reasons. The current penalties for speed racing on our public streets are not proportional to the extreme danger that the activity exposes both the participants and the public to. And we believe that we would like to use all the tools that are available to us to try to end this type of activity on our public streets. The bill in its current form would penalize drivers and participants convicted of speed racing with a Class A misdemeanor. We are currently working with legislative counsel to draft an amendment that would make drivers convicted of speed racing guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, participants and organizers who are convicted of speed racing guilty of a Class C misdemeanor. So we are seeking a change to the bill. The bill would also, in its present form, and we anticipate in the amended form, would require suspension of driving privileges if a conviction is obtained. For the first conviction, it would be 90-day suspension, 1 year subsequent second conviction, and 3 years suspension for any third conviction thereafter. Finally, the amendment would create an emergency clause making the bill effective upon passage. Let's see. Finally, I've asked Commander Garvey and Sergeant Rod Lusich to explain the way these folks are acting, number one, but also the culture related to speed racing, and they'll provide some examples to the committee of their experience dealing with these types of folks on our public streets in Portland and, frankly, throughout the state. Thank you.
Just say, isn't the Hot Rod show this weekend? Actually, if you go there, you can see some pretty incredible machines that some of these folks are putting together. It's pretty interesting. Commander Garvey?
Good morning. Mike Garvey, Commander of the Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division, City of Portland Bureau of Police. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for affording us a few moments of your valuable time today to come and talk to you about this issue. We think it's extremely important, and we won't take up too much of your time. I wanted to just give you a little bit of a background on the evolution of what we've seen with regard to the issue of speed racing. You know, you probably remember some of the old movies where, you know, groups of people would go out in their old big hot rods and find these very secluded locations and get out there, and somebody would be down at the end of this track, and they would do the James Dean handkerchief drop and two cars would go off. In the movies, sometimes people got hurt pretty bad and sometimes they didn't. But there was always a lot of excitement and a lot of activity going on surrounding these events. Well, it really started evolving a few years ago in our jurisdiction from the movies to reality. And what we started seeing were a lot of these souped-up aftermarket cars that were being developed by these very young people to be very powerful cars. And the reason behind it started out, I think, to be looks, but then it turned into the performance, and clearly performance in racing one another at different locations. As they continued to evolve into these really, really fancy cars, the groups started to grow. And, of course, it became a big business for aftermarket producers of items for these cars. But additionally, the groups grew faster than we could keep track of them. And eventually got to the point where, you know, we were looking at anywhere from 50 to 100 of these vehicles gathering in certain select parts of our city and then racing on these public roadways and racing in areas that were totally open to the public. We received complaints from different individuals who would be on their way to work late at night and all of a sudden would have two cars coming at them at very, very high rates of speed, creating an extremely dangerous situation. As the evolution occurred, so did the sophistication of the operators, but their youth levels did not grow. In fact, to a certain extent, they diminished. They became able to coordinate their activities with different types of communications equipment, and if the police showed up at one area, they would go to another area in a pre-staged location and conduct their racing there. As the evolution continued to grow, so did our beginning of our fatality rates and serious problems that occurred due to crashes because of these racers. Sergeant Lucich will talk a little bit about that. We felt it was necessary to make some changes in the city of Portland and in our jurisdiction with regard to how we were going to address this problem, and became somewhat aggressive in doing so because we felt there were such great dangers in this type of racing. Clearly, these groups that were gathering were also organized. There had to be certain numbers of people that were capable of bringing these large groups of youth together and that were responsible for identifying the locations, kind of the race rules that they would operate by. They had a lot of handy walkie-talkies. They were the ones that developed these predisposed locations. I remember working one night out on the street where we had gone down to Swan Island where we were getting complaints. And down on Swan Island, you've got a lot of steel workers and others coming and going from the shipyards. And the blatant racing that was going on out on the public roadways right in our clear view was absolutely unacceptable. At reaching speeds of 60, 70, 80 miles an hour in those stretches, where clearly these kids didn't have the ability to control these vehicles. And secondly, you never knew when some unsuspecting person was going to pull out of a 7-Eleven and be mowed down by these racers. So it really got to the point where it rose to epidemic proportions. We still are seeing it in our general area, and we feel that it is absolutely so critical to ensure that sanctions are in place for this kind of activity that we're here today to talk to you about increasing the level of sanction with regard to speed racing. Sergeant Lucich has got testimony prepared and also has got some very, very specific information concerning what we've been seeing lately. So, Rod, I'll turn it over to you.
Sergeant. Thank you, Commander. Chairperson Minnis and committee, it's a pleasure to be here and to share some information. For the last 3 years in the Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division, I've been faced with this problem of taking citizen complaints in regards to danger, vandalism, noise, things that had specifically to do with community livability on one hand, and then traffic safety and community safety on the other. I'm not sure which was the worst. The most frustrating thing that I was hearing from citizens was the fact that a lot of people, for instance, when they go down, when the racers would go down to the industrial area, it's kind of cat and mouse. They did, as Commander Garvey mentioned, have a lot of communication, push-to-talk, and cell phones that the racers themselves would use to try to outfox the police. And quite frankly, the resources were so limited to what we could do, because they'd hear us coming or see us coming, and they'd split in a thousand directions. And it was really a very non-productive way of doing business. And if we did catch them, it was difficult to do anything about it. A quick ticket, and off they went, for an equipment violation. Because it was hard to catch them in the act without some kind of extra things going on there. So for those that would call in repeatedly saying, we just get to sleep, and they start up. And we're not talking a couple of cars. Sometimes it was 60 to 100. And these are high-performance cars, Acuras and such, lowered down with nitrous boosts and things. I mean, people would spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on their individual cars. And so you could hear them from a long way, and just the basic way that they did business was such that they didn't try too hard to be quiet. So it was a deal where I'd send out officers, and we'd try to kind of sneak up on them. But to try to answer and be responsive to the citizens' complaints, and yet we were really unequipped to deal with it. So at the time when the city of Portland passed an ordinance in dealing with speed racing last May, or excuse me, March, we had in the years prior that I had quite a bit of speed racing incidences, and not all of them, in fact, a few of them ended in fatalities. But when it got to the point, you knew it was a matter of time. And I also want to point out that though there is a culture of speed racers that that work in mass, that primarily what we've been talking about, it's not always just that. We had in January of 2001, we had down in the industrial area of Northwest Portland, down by one of the steel manufacturing plants, we had a 50-year-old white male racing a 20 white male in his 20s, and at that this was an after work type of a thing. A semi pulled out in front of them, they couldn't stop, they ended up going underneath one, and one of the people was killed. And so it's not just young people in their teens and 20s, it's people some of our age and just motivated by other interests. And and it's not any.
Sure. Excuse me, Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the what's been described to us is sort of a contest of speed organizational structure. But don't we also have just pickup races on the street where people pull up to a stoplight and glances are exchanged, engines revved, and then the green light becomes the starting tree and away they go.
Yes.
Isn't that far more common than the organized speed contest?
I won't say that it's far more common, because prior to our ordinance, this was at least the weekends and sometimes one or two other nights. This was what the organized group of people that engage in this is what they did for entertainment.
Rod, if I could, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think one of the things that happens is, though, that, and if we're looking at this from a statewide perspective, you have these people that are involved with these 60 and 100, and they're doing their thing, but it gets in their system. So even if they're not with the group, and somebody pulls up to them and gives them the nod, they're ready to go. They've got that car ready. They've got their nitrous oxide, whatever junk they put in those things. They've got their little wing flap on the back of the car, and some guy pulls up in his Dodge 350 pickup with the diesel turbo Hemi engine in it, and they're looking at one another. And if they can find an opportunity in a straight stretch to do that type of thing, it does happen. And Rod has a very clear example of that. I mean, where we have the biggest impact, of course, is these large groups that are roaming around. But we've still written a variety of citations for speed racing to individuals that are pulling up and doing that as well. So I think that that can be a I think that not only does it happen, but it's certainly a major byproduct of what we've been dealing with.
Mr. Chairman, follow up, please.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
The the penalties proposed in the bill, it would be an increase of criminality by changing this thing to a more serious misdemeanor and possibly the suspension of driving privileges. And, Mr. Chairman, I just don't see that as a deterrent. If you want to deter folks from doing this, there ought to be some sort of an impoundment of the vehicle for a period not less than a year. I mean, something serious.
I always wanted to take them and have them smashed.
The cars.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
people.
It's not really a
forfeiture.
Mr. Chairman, the forfeiture, if you get into a forfeiture situation, then you just invite the wrath of the civil libertarian and due process and some other stuff. But impoundment of the vehicle so that it's just not available to be driven for a period seems to me to be a much more effective deterrent than increasing the misdemeanor. I mean, a misdemeanor, I think the folks that put nitrous oxide into the dash are not going to be deterred by the prospect of a more serious misdemeanor crime or even a 90-day suspension. But I think they would react in the appropriate manner if threatened with the loss of the vehicle itself for a period. At least the use of the vehicle, the car payments go on, the security value is undiminished. But that seems to me to be
bankers.
Exactly. Well, seizure does. Forfeiture of the vehicle would cause the banking community to come out and say, look, we got a problem here because that's our security.
Right.
But if the vehicle wasn't actually seized, just impounded at the expense of the miscreant, then I think you've got a much more effective deterrent. And I guess I'd also, a technical question, if there's 60 or 70 or 100 people showing up at these prearranged contests of speed, they are just as great a participant as the drivers. And does this statute also cover those kinds of instances?
Okay. Is that a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Whomever.
Well, I'll respond if it's okay.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Chairman Minnis and Senator Ferrilli. We found as we were in the city of Portland, we're trying to find remedy to this. I agree with what you're saying. Bottom line is we felt like we had to have a twofold approach. There has to be a significant, I suppose for any of us, a significant amount, a reason enough for it to make it painful or inconvenient for us to stop our behavior. And in addition to that, not wanting to be naive, because there was in the organized element of this, this is what they're saying, this is what we do for entertainment. And we're saying, you know, we're not here to rain on your parade. We're concerned about the safety of people on our public streets and in premises open to the public, and we want to make sure that if you want to do that, that's fine. So we did a twofold approach to try to open up PIR so that they would have, we gave them opportunity to put their money where their mouth was and say, you're saying that you're just doing it because you like to race and you're not just out there to be rebels, so here's the track. So just as an example, when we passed prior to this ordinance, we opened up PIR and made it apparent, and so that folks would know about it. Then, we on that same night that it opened up, there was quite a turnout. But keeping in mind there was no legislation that really dealt with this, the ordinance was not in existence, and so a lot of people showed at the track, maybe a couple hundred, different vehicles to race. But through some surveillance on my part, I was able to learn that yes, they did that for a little bit, and then splinter groups began breaking off and turned in. There was one group that was 60 vehicles long that went to it away from the track. The track is still open so they could race safely, and they went to an industrial location a few miles from that in group. Some of them drove without their headlights on and went to a different location, and when they got to the different location, there were people that, though it was somewhat separate, there were people that came around the corner, they kept right on racing, so the dangerous behavior was substantially there. So as I appealed to the council, you have to have, even if you open up a track, you're going to have problems with this unless you have some kind of hook that you can say enough's enough, and it's going to cost you if you choose to do it. So bottom line is that with our ordinance, we did have to go that route, and there are impoundment fees that go along with that, and there is a it's just long enough for them to for us to process the paperwork, but we're holding them accountable for that. And maybe where you're going with that.
So what you're suggesting is that the city of Portland has an ordinance that does impound the vehicle?
Yes. It has an impoundment, but it's not a seizure. If it's a temporary.
And Mr. Chair.
What's the length of the impoundment?
When we talk about impoundment, we don't... you've got to go through a process. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ferriola. You have to go through a process in order to get your vehicle back. But currently, after we instituted this ability to seize these vehicles, we saw a substantial decrease in these large numbers of individuals that were out gathering outside of PIR. We have continued to leave PIR open. But it's this car... this piece of steel is near and dear to each one of these folks. It's not just going out and driving a car. It's their baby. So when you have that sanction out there where you take their baby away from them for a period of time, they're worried about things being stolen out of it, the car being damaged. I mean, because they've got their heart and soul in this piece of equipment. So it has it's had a huge impact on herding people back over to PIR. And not allowing them to be out and about in their groups, spontaneously erupting in these different parts of the city. The other thing is what you end up with now when you're dealing with people that are speed racing on the streets are a pretty hardcore element. If it's the one-on-one, you know, you're looking at this guy and then people are ready to go. And we believe that definitely pushes this to the level of the Class A misdemeanor as well as the license suspension and taking the vehicle, because those folks are the ones that we still have out there that haven't gotten the message yet. So,
and Mr. Chair, I'd just point out, it's my understanding, first of all, Multnomah County also has an impound ordinance, and I've also learned, I believe, that the county of Hood River, I believe, also has an impound ordinance related to speed racing. That's what my understanding is. So the problem is being recognized, and local jurisdictions are attempting to deal with it in the fashion that you're suggesting, Senator Ferrioli. Those are the places, at least, where a concentrated problem has been identified.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just mention that, have we, maybe to put it, to look at the results, have we seen a total drop in any kind of speed racing since we've had our ordinance? No. Organized wise, I'd say, as far as any information I've gotten, I think we have, from the moment that ordinance passed, we got instant results, better than what I had hoped for. I thought I would have to go out, we would have to go out and make some kind of a initial statement, you know, in an organized way. But we didn't. We traveled fast. We did public awareness, and that did happen. Do we have we eradicated speed racing in the state of Oregon? No. Some things are problematic because one of my biggest fears was that it started out with Gresham having a speed racing ordinance before us, and that made it Portland's problems because soon as they're well networked and they know that where they can get away with certain things. My fear was that once we had our ordinance in place, then they would go to Clackamas County, would go to Woodburn, and there really isn't any protection or instrument into place to take care of it outside.
Although
that.
Rod, it's kind of payback because all the gangs have moved to Gresham. So.
Yes,
Senator Burdick has a question or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you stop these people for speed racing, what's their insurance status generally? Are they generally insured?
Yes, they usually are, because there is a lot of money tied up, either for theft or for any other reason. There's a lot to lose. I mean, in addition to, take for instance, maybe a one-year-old Acura that maybe cost them $15,000 when they started, they probably have, you know, $25,000 in it, maybe, with all these little extras. So there's a lot to be. They're very concerned about their vehicles, Commander Garvey.
Okay, so the because I was seeing that as a condition of getting rid of the suspension, they have to show financial responsibility. But that's just
yes.
routine.
Yes.
Does the impoundment that you have, is that similar or identical to the impoundment that you have for failure to have insurance? How do they differ?
The impoundment procedure is more closely tied that the average person that we would tow in a routine traffic stop, if you could call it that, for not having insurance, is not the same impoundment procedure. That's a towing, and then they show proof of insurance and they get the vehicle back. This one is a procedure that they need to go through our impoundment process. The paperwork is done, and we hold them accountable for, in addition to the citation that they would receive, which is separate with the courts, they would have some fees that we're essentially holding them accountable for the time it takes for the police officers to handle the situation on the street and write the reports and for the paperwork to be processed. Essentially, we're charging them for their services that they're requiring us to do.
Okay. And then another question, if I could, Mr. Chairman. How many injuries and fatalities have you had in recent years from speed racing in Portland?
Well, when we took this information to the council, it just as we were getting it ready, in the time from December 14th to between then and about, I think it was the second week in January, we'd had 6 traffic fatalities associated with speed racing in that very short period of time, in about 3 weeks. So although as I've mentioned, we've had a long time where we had some kind of horrific accidents that people walked away, went airborne and so on. It just wasn't resulting in deaths, but we knew that the clock was ticking, and then all of a sudden, boy, started to happen. And a lot of times it was innocent parties that were the victims of the fatalities. In fact, at the city council, we even had one of the widows of an elderly gentleman that was killed because he pulled out on the street when a speed contest was in process, and it cost him his life.
Thank you.
Well, do you know in that particular case whether the individual in the race was charged with a negligent homicide or?
It was.
Yeah, they were.
In that way,
we
yes.
pursued it along those lines, Chairman Minnis, and we ended up with a major conviction with regard to that individual.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I talked to the DA Snowden, who I think prosecuted a couple of those. I know that one was prosecuted. I believe already sustained a conviction for criminally negligent homicide. And so there was another one. I think that one was 60 months, I believe. There was another one where there was a young girl as a passenger, as I recall, and that one also is a conviction. She was 11 years old, passenger in one of the cars.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we have statutory construct that deals with the event of a serious injury or a death. We are trying to prevent that, I assume, is where we're going for it. All right. Mark, do you know whether there's a defect or a potential defect in terms of the authorization for local county ordinances or city ordinances that authorize impoundment of vehicles?
Chair Minnis, not to my knowledge. And I'm not quite clear on your question.
Well,
is there an inherent defect in...
Right. Oftentimes, I know in the construction of criminal statutes, generally, and I know this case, I can't remember the name of it, that a local government could not have a criminal law that was inconsistent with state statutes or different. I'm not sure that applies to issues of impoundment, et cetera. So.
It is my understanding, Chair Minnis, that if state law does not cover a particular area, a local government may put its footprint in that vacuum, so to speak. As a result, the state of Oregon, at least with regard to speed racing, has stated that it is a Class A traffic infraction if a person is found guilty of speed racing. The state does not speak to, however, impoundment of a vehicle if somebody is suspected of speed racing. And that's, I believe, the theory that we have used to enact our ordinance, if that gets to your question, Chair.
Well, I think what I'll do is ask Craig to do some research for us to make sure that we're on good ground. I mean, you're doing your stuff on the local level. I want to make sure that if we can assist in constructing something in state statute that would prevent overturning local impound ordinances that we do that while we're in session, as opposed to some crafty attorney someplace coming up with a challenge that throws them all out, which seems to happen from time to time. Any other questions? Senator Ringo, you're being very quiet today. We're not talking about insurance companies yet.
This is fascinating. It makes me recall my days of being young and foolish. I think many of us probably had certain moments like that, but it all sounds reasonable to me.
I just a couple of questions, Rod, Commander Garvey. Is it... would it be possible to actually prove a case of organizing a speed race if that was a crime?
Yes.
Okay.
Chairman and members of the committee, if we had the right tools and the right elements, absolutely. There's when you go out to these different areas, and you spend much time with these kids, you can see who the individuals are that have the communications equipment, and you can start backtracking an investigation, I think, very much as you would going to a crime scene and then trying to figure out what actually occurred at that scene. So, and we've got several people that, if you stop somebody, you can negotiate for information, and they're willing to, as long as you're not going to tow their car, they'll give you anything that you want, just about. So, I mean, there's a variety of tools we can use, I think. Do you have any more to add to that, Mark?
Yes, Chairman, if I could say that when we looked with our city attorneys in regards to this ordinance, one of the encumbrances we put on the police officers is, although the violation of speed racing is a Class A traffic violation, $295 base fine, and normally we just would not need probable cause. For the purposes of the ordinance, we made it incumbent on the police officer in enforcing that they have probable cause level that raised to that specific point. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, as an example, if a police officer came around the corner and there was two vehicles lined up in the roadway and maybe two other vehicles parked along the side of the roadway there, and maybe this was in a semi-business or semi-residential area, and the two people that were parked on the side of the road were out of their vehicles and appeared to be watching, could the officer articulate probable cause that when he comes around the corner and sees these two people obviously ready to racing, and maybe they're beginning even burning off the tires, can he articulate that those people there on the side of the road are there 100%? Probably not, based on that information. But in the instance that I did on that one night that I talked to you about where we opened up the roadway, I saw this group of 60 cars, roughly, go from Portland Meadows racetrack parking lot out Marine Drive and then east on Marine Drive as a caravan, with some certain specific behavior, to a location where nobody else was there. And you can clearly articulate then that they went from point A, point B, to participate in this event, and it was clear. And at that particular point, you could say, yes, because we anticipated that, we'd be getting the call from the parent of one of these people who we towed their car, saying my kid was just in the area, he had nothing to do with this, and we'd say, excuse me, no, he went from all this distance, and so on. So there is a responsibility to be able to articulate, and it would be that level of responsibility as probable cause if on the state level it was a misdemeanor. So in some situations, Chair Menace and committee members, we probably couldn't, but all things considered, with good police work and good observations, we might be able to prove it for some of the people there and not for others.
Okay.
But we feel that it clearly made a big difference on our effectiveness, that it wasn't just the two people racing, because it takes, George Foreman's fighting Ali. If nobody pays tickets to come, there's not going to be a fight. And we took the same attitude. And clearly everybody knows that if they're there, they run a risk of at least temporarily losing their vehicle and being cited.
Okay. All right. I think, are there questions?
Just one last question. You mentioned Portland International Raceway. Exactly what did you do to set that up? I think that's pretty cool that you had Karen as well as a stick on this. Just very briefly, how did you go about arranging that?
Chair Menace and committee members, We essentially, there is a fee involved in it, and there also is a group of these folks that, as Commander Garvey mentioned, there are accessory supply folks that have an interest in this too, and so because they sell these fancy parts to make these hot cars, and in doing that, they went to PIR race officials and city officials to get that that information across to them to say, we need to do something here. So it was a cooperative effort, and outside the city of Portland, it could be something real likely that would be centrally located, Woodburn, drag strip, something like that. It takes, I think, if the cost of doing that business on our public streets and makes life unsafe for our families and ourselves is significant enough, then they will take the steps to, and we are certainly a partner in that to helping facilitate that, they'll take the steps to find a place to do it safely if they're really sincere about what they want to do.
Thank you.
And just to further, Chairman and Senator Burdick, to further discuss this issue, it also gives us a really good opportunity for education. This year we're going to expand the program. We're going to have an officer that will spend a fair amount of time out at PIR. We're going to conduct inspections of these vehicles as they're coming in, mainly equipment violations and so forth, and give them a notice that indicates, you know, you should try and get this fixed. We're looking at how do we take this opportunity where we've got all these folks together and try and improve not only our relations with them, but improve the way that they look at things and kind of help them starting to address some of the responsibilities they have as drivers. So we're looking at expanding it in that direction.
All right, good. I think what we're going to do, because my fertile mind has come up with a few more ideas to pursue in this, and I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to see if we can construct a very narrow statute that might be a C felony for intentionally organizing the speed race, and put together the, you know, the elements of that and what you would have to prove, because I think you'd have to have a fairly high threshold.
Yes.
And my assumption is there would be very few people that would actually be charged with or prosecuted in this case, but it does then have other implications, and so we may want to have two separate bills. One survives and the other one doesn't die in Ways and Means or something of that nature.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And then I want to also do a little bit more research on the issue of the impoundment process. All right? Okay, good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Testimony, and we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 90 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. Just briefly, just to keep the bill alive, I understand that the Department of Transportation is interested in the bill we just heard, but this may be the second vehicle. No,
good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Casales. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 189 is brought to you on behalf of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, a five-member governor-appointed body that was hearing complaints and issues and concerns from local neighborhood associations, from local traffic safety committees, as well as from officers that were working the street and seeing these cases, as you just heard described in the prior bill. Senate Bill 189 is strictly aimed at the pre-planned, organized individuals for sponsoring speed racing events. This does not do anything with participants. It does not have any impact on those that are spectators. It is strictly the people that are organizing it. The intent is to create the criminal offense of organizing these events on public roadways. Our understanding is the way that particular line in the bill states, that says open to the public, may be a misstatement and cause an issue with events such as at PIR, which is described, or Woodburn or Medford or Bend and other places where these are going on. That is not the intent of the bill. It is meant to be impacting on public roadways. Some of the items, Mr. Chair, that you had mentioned about potentially having a higher threshold of proof in relationship to the organization, that we agree. There is evidence, though, quite often that is found in with flyers, pagers, and there are websites that advertise these events that individuals can go in and access with passwords and other things. The department wanted to bring this forward on behalf of those that were interested in having concerns, and we would urge your support of Senate Bill 189. And Mr. Chair, I would also like to mention if it's your desire to look at merging some of these items together into some sort of comprehensive bill, that we would have no pride of authorship and have no concern with your intent to do that.
All right, thank you very much.
After that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, the origin of this bill is the Traffic Safety Commission, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you very much. Any questions? There are none. Thank you very much. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 189, or you can go back to Senate Bill 90 if anybody wants to testify? If not, there's no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.